you very much. Resume the hearing. And Ms. Baker Galloway, you're here for Universal Developments, Hawea Limited?
Correct.
The right one. This will be Mr. Hockney, I presume?
Yes, it is.
You raised a procedural issue in a memorandum. We should address that first.
Thank you.
And over to you.
Well, it wasn't an application for anything as such. It was just felt duty-bound to bring to the Chair's attention a series of statements on behalf of Mr. McLeod, Commissioner McLeod, that over time, particularly the more recent ones, one in the public hearing and one on a confidential basis from a member of the public, just raised issues as to whether an independent observer might consider that Commissioner Councillor McLeod had made a predetermination of the outcome of this rezoning submission. So rather than just leaving that unaddressed, I wanted to raise it with the Chair, leave it to the Chair's discretion to take advice if you thought that was necessary or to otherwise address it as you see fit.
My immediate reaction reading your memorandum was that you'd need to produce a bit more than what you produced for me to take external advice. I think that you've heightened our awareness to the issue, and I think that that's as far as I should take it at the moment, and then we'll play it by ear.
Thank you. We're happy to live with whatever decision you were going to make and accept that you'll put in place whatever protections you need to protect the credibility of the panel's decision.
Understood. And you've provided us with your legal submissions, which we have read. I have read Mr. Hocking's summary of submission, mm-hmm. summary of evidence, but I haven't read any of the other summaries you've given us. But I suggest that, well, we've got the rest of the afternoon to deal as thoroughly as we need to deal with all of the issues. I think we told you that of your cast of witnesses, the only one we didn't want to talk to was Mr. Davis.
Yes, so he's not here.
I think it's probably fair to say that there are some we have identified as of greater interest than others. I think I'd take that personally. And also thank you for the input on the NPSUD, which you will appreciate we are still in the process of getting to grips with,
yes.
But being progressively assisted by the parties who are appearing for us. So we had an interesting discussion with Mr. Page this morning.
Mm-hmm.
He was here for another submitter, and Mr. Edgar, who also provided us with input.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're ready to talk to you about that, and I think we should forewarn you that you shouldn't assume that the questions we asked you are necessarily directed at your client's position, because we're trying to get an overall understanding of what the document means, both for the purposes of considering this submission and the other submissions, particularly the ones we will hear next week regarding industrial and zoning in Wanaka.
Right, understood.
So, as I say, don't look behind the question. We may be flying a kite that has no relevance to the Universal case.
Right.
However, with that introduction, over to you how you want to handle your legal submissions. As I say, we have read them,
mm-hmm.
and I suppose that I certainly don't want you to read them. But
no, I won't read them. If you've read them, that's a good start. Before I launch into those, though, as you might have picked up, some of the supplementary/summary documents we lodged last night are a little over 2 pages.
I didn't open them.
Yeah, so
I observed that, I think Mr. Hopkins was 4.
Yes. So for the sake of process, in your hands, do you want me to formally apply for leave and then give you a wee explanation as to why they've gone over and been more than just a summary and to a certain extent are a bit of rebuttal to the council's rebuttal.
Given, let's play it by ear.
Okay.
And as I say, it's not going to be an issue that's going to mean, well, we've got the rest of the afternoon. If your witnesses have got, I might get seriously agitated if they've got 20 pages.
No one's got overtaken. I think 8 is the maximum.
I know that Mr. Carr would be the recalcitrant individual.
I'm heavy on the graphics, Commissioner, to avoid words, but it has meant that the length of it has got longer.
But not of words.
Well, we'll see what we can see in that case.
But they are, I mean, Mr. Carr's evidence is a very clearly a response to some important matters of detail raised by the council's expert that are directly relevant to the ability for the upgrades to occur.
So as I say, we'll play it by ear. We're not short of time, I don't think.
No.
If we get to 4:30 and we've still got 3 witnesses to go, I might have a different view.
Yeah, very good. All right, well, in that case, I'll just start talking to my legal submissions and look at what I want to emphasise. You'll be real familiar with the bundle of zonings that's now being sought, so I don't need to go over that. Just, I guess, one point to note in my paragraph 2C is that and Mr. Williams covers this in his evidence, is that the area for the school is now made more clearly as an indicative school site. Because until you've got Ministry of Education's sort of acceptance of all that, there's not much point in proposing a zone, and we certainly can't, and we don't have the ability to propose a designation. But at least it, as Mr. Williams says, forewarns those around that site of the potential use that they might be buying a house next to, in just terms of reverse sensitivity. In paragraph 3, I touch on the resource consent granted to the special housing area. And I think it is worth reminding you, or at least giving you a summary of the affordability gains from that consent. And Mr. Hocking's going to talk about imminent implementation. The 12.5% of allotments are to be given to the Housing Trust. And stage one front loads a 20% requirement of that, so they're not all going to be left to the end. And then there are additional commitments to affordability that are quite prescriptive and detailed in the special housing deed. Some of them are tied in by a restrictive covenant in terms of restricting transfer from the developer to purchasers, and others are just in the deed of agreement between council and the developer. There's a lot of emphasis in the obligations on ensuring there are home build packages that are going to be built at the prescribed price points that relate directly to KiwiSaver and so on. So it's quite a comprehensive framework, and if you've got further questions about that, both Mr. Hocking and Mr. Williams are over the detail in terms of how that's being brought to the market soon, like this year. We have, as you would have picked up, and as did some of the council witnesses, we are referencing the existence of the resource consent now because it was granted in April and there were no appeals. We didn't reference that in the original submission, and we didn't reference that in the evidence in chief because of the early day of the granting of the consent. And there's a clause in the special housing deed that, it's applied fairly consistently across the district, that landowner can't use the, and the words are important, establishment of a special housing area as part of the receiving environment to justify subsequent plan change proposals, rezoning, submissions, resource consents. Now that, as you may or may not be aware, but that's got a particular meaning under the Housing Accord Act, establishment, and that's just that process up until when the Governor-General declares the area a special housing area on the Minister's recommendation. That's the establishment of the SHA, not the subsequent granting of a consent. So now that it's got a consent, that consent is a consent for all in the proper sense, intents and purposes under the Resource Management Act. It's not some sort of inferior consent that you can treat a little bit differently. You can't. It's a Resource Management Act consent. And so the every other way that you approach existing consents that are being implemented is, in my submission, the same treatment that you should give the resource consent for this Hawea site.
Thank you for that clarification.
I'll just touch on my paragraphs, well, 7, but also 8 in particular. So 7 just talks about the key features that, based on our experts' evidence, will ensure a quality urban development. We've got the provision of the structure plan. There's good pedestrian and cycle connectivity required, including the trail along the water race. I've referenced the school, and then there's there were initially a set of mechanisms to provide for a defensible edge, as well as mitigating visual amenity effects. But as I go on in paragraph 8, once we evaluated the council's evidence, those measures have been built upon. So now the 15 metre wide building restriction area will extend all the way along Domain Road boundary to Cemetery Road, instead of just a 5 metre wide portion. And I think I get onto this later in my submissions, but I just want to note that with that 15 metre wide BRA, I'd note that Ms Gilbert can now support that western edge as a defensible edge. So that change is being agreed to. And in B, the 15 metre BRA on the eastern side is proposed to be extended, but only up to the boundary of the consented area, because that consented area was approved with a different treatment on the edge. Mm-hmm. And if we were to supplant a 15 metre building restriction area on top of that, that would render that part of the consent unable to be implemented, and would put in doubt the sort of integrity of the consent, if you like. Again, the primary roading network has been added to the structure plan as recommended by Mr Barr, so we took on board that recommendation, with the primary roads within the SHA obviously fixed in accordance with the consented layout, and primary roads outside of the SHA able to be moved 50 metres. D is quite important because it's particularly relevant to the infrastructure questions that the experts have been grappling with. So taking on board that there is a process to be gone through, both in terms of just modelling what's required, but then in terms of putting in place the funding, the submitter is happy to volunteer a restricted discretionary subdivision framework instead of the standard. If you're in accordance with the structure plan, it's a controlled activity. And just again running with the standard restricted discretionary rule in Chapter 27 for low density residential, which clearly provides for servicing and roading as matters of discretion. So that's the consenting lever to ensure that at each stage where subdivision is applied for, there's a mechanism in place with proper teeth that means that council can be confident that infrastructure, servicing, roading upgrades will be provided at the appropriate time, with the developer funding it in the appropriate way, whether it's by developer agreement or development contributions. And I'll get onto infrastructure a little bit later as well. And then finally in E, we do support one of Ms Hampson's recommendations in part in respect of the local shopping centre zone, and that's the provision for one larger retail tenancy, most likely some sort of supermarket, but instead of the cap of 400 metres size that she recommended, we recommend the 1,000 square metres in case it is a supermarket. So, in terms of the, Section 74, the matters that have to be considered, I do want to emphasise the first one, because it, in terms of Section 31AA, which is referenced in Section 74, and that is this theme of ensuring there's sufficient development capacity in respect of housing and business land to meet the expected demands of the district. So you'll be well alive to the fact that this is one of the key points of difference still between council's experts and Universal Development's experts, is whether or not there is currently, in all the circumstances, including, you know, the land banking and so on, sufficient capacity being provided, being brought to the market, being able to be brought to the market to meet those needs. And so I did just want to highlight that that's not just a requirement that comes down from the National Policy Statement, it's a core function of Council under Section 31.
How long has it had that function?
Yeah, it's a newer one. It hasn't been there forever. Do you want me to find that out right now? I'll just dig it up. Hang on.
When you say there's a key point of difference between universal and your witnesses and
yep.
the council's position, are you saying that just in relation to housing?
No, it's in relation to the industrial zoning as well. Mm. Yeah. No, sorry, that to meet future demand, expected demands of the district. So that change, AA, April 2017, so prior to notification of stage 3. But I mean, Ms. Commissioner Dawson, if you do have further questions on that particular point, Mr. Hocking has got a working knowledge. He lives and works and develops in Wanaka, and has a working knowledge of the demand for industrial land, which would have formed the basis in part of the proposed industrial zoning, because he in his experience has seen a need for it.
Fair to say that we've got a succession of submitters lined up next week to tell us that there's already too much industrial land zoned in Wanaka, and seeking to reduce that.
Mm.
So I think Mr. Cotton needs to tell us his view of that too.
Yep, no, that's okay. We're prepared for that. Then paragraph 13, I do run through section 6, and this theme in terms of absence of adverse effects is, in my submission, an important one. Section 6, matters of national importance. No one is asserting there are adverse effects in this class, and in this district, that is a significant feature. Where you can help meet a significant issue that the district's facing, a significant challenge, without impacting on any Section 6 matters. And you'll be very live to the concern, even the Wahi Tupuna overlay and the attempt to address that particular Section 6 matter, the angst that that's causing, very recently they'll be really fresh in your minds. Well, there's none of those concerns here, which I think is a big, in my submission, something you can put a lot of weight on when looking at whether or not this proposal meets the purpose of the Act and the Regional Policy Statement and anything higher than that. And then Section 7 and Section 7B, the efficient use and development of natural and physical resources. Well, on that point, you would have read from several of our witnesses that the land that's the subject of the submission is not highly productive soil, it's not productive land through the application of lots of fertiliser or anything like that. So at the moment, the value that is coming out of that land is not a significant one compared to what's being proposed. And so in my submission, if you're looking at efficiency of use of land, it ticks the box for Section 7 as well on that particular point, Section 7B. And then Section 7C, yes, it is at best a Section 7C landscape, because it's obviously not an ONL, and it just sits in that default rural character landscape category that every other piece of rural land that's not ONL sits in. I encourage you to use a lot of rigour when looking at just how significant the Section 7C values are, given that it's just a default category, so there must be a scale, if you like, of important values from importance to less important in that Section 7C context. You're probably all familiar with this, but I'll say it because it's something that I think gets overlooked a lot when you're talking about Section 7C landscapes. It's an anthropocentric focus. It's about what people value. And so the evidence about what people value about the landscape and the visual amenity values of the site, there's not much. There's not a lot of evidence, well, there's no expert evidence from the community about how much they value the site. And there's minimal evidence from council's expert about actually verifying the anthropocentric values of people looking at the site. And I think it's just the residual concern of Ms. Gilbert is views of the site from the east, but again, no evidence of lots of people viewing it from the east, trails, traffic, people's views and so on. It's just something that there's not a lot of evidence on. So then when you look at the regional policy statement provision that I address later in my evidence, and perhaps I'll just jump to it so that I don't have to do it again. So if you turn quickly to page 9, and I refer there to the SETL, so the newly operative regional policy statement policy 3.2.6, that categorises these non-ONL landscapes as this concept of highly valued landscapes. So if there's an assumption, and I'm happy to say that there is an assumption, that this landscape is a highly valued landscape under the regional policy statement because it's a Section 7C landscape and it's rural character landscape in this plan, the direction in that policy is that significant adverse effects on values that contribute to the high value of the landscape are avoided. So the evidence from our expert is that, firstly, there are not any values that contribute to the high value of this landscape present on the site, and even if they were, there's no significant adverse effects on those values. So you're giving effect still to the RPS by approving this rezoning. So Mr. Espy is here to speak for himself, so I won't, and you've read my evidence, so I won't go over his reasons for being quite comfortable in supporting the upzoning. You'll no doubt have questions for him. And as I noted at paragraph 19, Ms. Gilbert still maintains the effects are inappropriate, but my reading is that that's primarily because of the views from the east. And those are also, just to remind us all, those are also the views that are already of the consented boundary of the consented boundary of the special housing area. So those views, most of those views, have already been approved as being appropriate through the HASHA process. And now that consent is a consent under the Resource Management Act, you have to give it the same weight as you would any other consent that's been approved.
Before you roll on, if I go, can I ask you about policy 6B of the new NPS,
yep.
The last clause of your paragraph 18, that the effect of that policy is changes of amenity are deemed to be not adverse.
Mm. Yes.
I had a discussion with Mr. Page about this morning. The issue I have is that I had always understood that whether something is an adverse effect or not is a question of fact. And I did not understand that a planning document can alter the facts. Famously, Legal System 101 tells us that Parliament can deem black to be white, but I don't think an RMA policy document can do that. So What is the effect of this policy? Can it really say that if you have evidence that something is amenity effect, this policy document says, no, it's not?
Good question. One response is, as a matter of principle, I'm asking myself, not you, what's the difference between that and the permitted baseline?
The permitted baseline's in section 104. That is Parliament saying that something is different to what it's what it might otherwise be.
But that's what I mean. As a matter of principle, what's the difference between the statute saying there is an adverse effect, but you have the discretion to disregard it, and a national policy statement that's trying to create a more comprehensive planning framework to address a matter of national importance, also saying that.
Haven't you just given the answer? Section 104 says you have a discretion to disregard it. It doesn't say it doesn't exist. You're saying that the effect of policy 6B is
not adverse.
It is not adverse.
The other comparison, just thinking about this principle, is an effective party approval form does literally make an adverse effect cease to exist in terms of decision makers, what they can take into account.
That's the same thing. That's a
creature of statute. Yeah.
Well, firstly, it's a creature of statute. Secondly, it's not saying it doesn't exist. It just says you can disregard it.
You can disregard it. And the other thought I just had was in the operative and the proposed district plan at the moment, in one of the assessment matters in the rural chapter, it says trees that were planted after 2002, something that cannot be should not be considered as part of the permitted baseline. So it tries to contract out of the permitted baseline concept in the Act, and that it's not quite the same as what you're talking about or what your question is. To answer your question more helpfully, I would just like to look at, and I won't do it on the fly, but I can in the afternoon tea adjournment, the section about what a national policy statement can and can't do. I could just have a quick look at that over the break and see if there's anything in there that's
I suppose assistance. I should tell you, as part of the background, that I was involved in a Board of Inquiry hearing where the solution adopted by the board was to deem something not to be the case, and I was unable to convince a High Court judge that that was a legitimate planning decision, because the court drew a distinction between something that was deemed to be what it was not for legal purposes, from as opposed to a factual deeming, saying something is what that it is which that which it is not.
Yeah.
You probably can guess what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it rings a bell. Yeah. Yes. Okay, all right. Yeah, well, like I say, I'll just have another look at if there's any helpful commentary or other parts of the Act that can give you more confidence that you can simply give effect to that policy direction in the NPS, or if you need, I guess, further direction. Because, at the moment, we have to implement it on the face of it to give effect to it.
The introductory words to policy 6, just talking about having particular regard.
Particular regard, that's right.
Say,
no.
This is the word.
No, it's only particular. It's only particular regard, that's right. So there's still an element of discretion in there.
I understand what you're saying about we're duty bound to give effect to. King Salmon says, if we think it's legally invalid, which would be a hard thing to do, do when it was gazetted the week before last.
Mm.
But hence I'm out looking for you to tell me why it's lawful, if that is in fact the meaning, correct meaning.
Mm. I mean, the other, I don't even know if you can apply for a declaration to get this particular question clarified one way or another.
Well, looking at it another way, the Commissioner's identified one route through, that it's not in fact a direction.
No.
The other thing is, what does it mean when it says of themselves?
Mm. Well, the way I read that subclause B is that change in the context of providing for more housing and commercial land, change to the amenity value experienced by people, that change itself is not adverse, it's change, like it's not denying that there will be change, it's just saying that that change is not adverse in the because of the importance of what this NPS is trying to achieve.
Is it because of the importance, or is it, or it just saying that it's not inherently adverse, that you would need evidence? Because I've used that concept. I've seen that concept used, for instance, give you an example, in the context of iwi values, that some things are not inherently contrary to iwi values, but they may be contrary to the values of a particular hapu.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so you can't make assumptions.
Yeah.
Because some iwi are happy with something, that means everyone is.
Yeah, no, that's right. I totally agree.
So that would be an analogy. Is that what it's saying? It's
trying to make the decision maker step back in terms of scale.
What's the evidence?
And say, yes, that person who's living next to this change, at that scale that's adverse, but when you step back and look at it at a broader scale, I mean, that's probably reading too much into it.
Well, is it that difference, or is it, yes, it's changed, but what is the actual evidence of the amenity effect that results from that change?
Because the change has to involve a detraction from the amenities for some and an improvement for others.
Yep.
Mm.
So it can't just be
just a detraction.
Just an improvement and just a distraction.
Yep. Yep.
So there has to be that the change between detraction and improvement.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps a site-specific adverse effect.
Yep.
At a general level, just because there's a change from one to the other, isn't necessarily adverse, but there may be certain...
But case by case,
yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So case by case, there may be a significant adverse change that's not outweighed by a marginal benefit.
Yeah.
But in this case, we'd obviously say that there's a significant benefit to those in the community who can't currently afford to buy a house or afford to rent a house that's modern and warm and so on. So there's a significant benefit, we say, to those people, and there is not any evidence of a significant adverse effect to any people, particularly from a sort of objective, independent standpoint. Council's called no social expert, even in terms of its own upzoning of Hawea, let alone to address the submission from Universal Developments, and neither has the primary submitter in opposition to this called any expert evidence to sort of validate any feeling of the community objectively, so that it can be properly weighted and assessed.
On the other hand, they may well well tell us, as the representatives of the community, what the community feeling is, that's not necessarily an adverse amenity effect either.
That's correct.
But I think it's safe to assume that that may be what we hear.
Oh, yes. I mean, but the fact that people don't like change is not an I think that's not an adverse effect. That's a very common thing throughout all of our communities, is that not most people, especially vocal people, aren't good at change, and so that theme will come through. But I don't think you can put much weight on that as an actual adverse effect.
Is that sort of what B2 is saying?
Mm.
Yeah.
It's not inherently
there. Yeah.
And you need. Well, I would go the next step and ask, do you? Is it saying you can't produce evidence that it is actually bad to one person for the following 15 reasons, because that's what your submission suggests?
Mm-hmm.
And is it, with the benefit of hindsight and this discussion, do you think that that's pushing it too far?
No, I think the point that Commissioner Dawson brought up is important to hold on to, which is there's still a discretion within giving effect to this policy. There is still a discretion for you to weigh whatever evidence you might get about adverse effects against relevant positive effects for the people that will benefit from this rezoning in terms of meeting an unmet significant need.
And that's with reference to have particular regard to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm. In the way that B1 sort of sets out what it is that the change consists of.
Yep.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Helpful. So on page 6, I talk a little bit about Ms. Gilbert's evidence some more on landscape effects. And I think I emphasised at the start that Ms. Gilbert can now support the western boundary with the 15 metre BRA, that's in her rebuttal paragraph 5.8, to the south, whilst she's very honest, she would prefer the water race as a defensible boundary. She can support the boundary that we're proposing at her 5.17. And so, as I talked about before, her primary concern is that eastern boundary. But in my submission, it's not appropriate for her or the decision maker to sort of second guess what's already consented along that second boundary. And in my submission, the viewing audience of that second boundary is a limited audience, and the amenity values, based on our evidence, are not important amenity values anyway, and the effects on what's there are not significant anyway. So at least at that regional policy statement level, where we have a settled policy to give effect to, in my submission, given that, the boundary of the eastern portion is appropriately addressed, up to the boundary of the special housing area consent, and then beyond that it's already approved. And there was just other one, I don't think I've written it down either, but there was one other point that Ms. Gilbert and maybe Mr. Barr made as well about both I think really going beyond their expertise, so I do think it's important to point it out because we disagree with it, and that's that the rezoning, universal developments rezoning will change the vibe or the feel of the Hauwea Township. Now, again, it's not really for a landscape expert to put much weight on that sort of assumption, nor is it even for an expert planner. But having said that, what both of those experts really disregard is that the council's own upzoning and encouragement and enabling of infilling could equally have a similar effect. So if you are going to place any weight on it, which I submit you probably shouldn't, that's an important aspect to bear in mind as well, that Hauwea is already on the path towards change, or at least an opportunity for change, by way of council's own upzoning proposals. Sorry.
Is the reality that at the point when the ambit of township of Hawea came down off the moraine to the flat land behind it, the pass was sold.
Yes, the seal's already broken. Yep.
In terms of the outlook of the nature of the town.
The nature of the town.
And the social fabric of the town.
Mm, that's right. The change is already happening. The horse is bolted, whatever metaphor you want to use.
Didn't Miss Gilbert use those exact words?
Oh, did she?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, who would have thought?
Yeah.
What
I'm shocked. Yeah, you're plagiarising.
What sort of witness would cover changes to the vibe of Hawea Township? Well, it's not a manor or a landscape.
A social impact assessment would cover that if it was really important, and could cover it objectively with a proper, you know, whatever deemed appropriate survey of the community, to, you know, what's the baseline vibe, feeling, what's important to people who live there about the town. Will it change with what's proposed, or is it already changing? Is that change inevitable? Is the sleepy holiday home / quiet town to live in already gone? You know, that's where you could get proper data on that, but...
Well, that's not the nature of the expertise, it's the nature of the data on which that opinion is based.
Understand the commissioner's point, but effectively you're looking for a sociologist.
If you were to put any weight on it, on that assertion that it's an adverse effect that's relevant to your determination, which in my submission it isn't, but if you were to put any weight on it, it would need the backing of that sort of evidence. Now, I wasn't going to expand on my Section 32 section unless you had any specific questions on that.
Any questions on the votes?
No. And then the next section of my submissions is on the new NPS. What I've emphasised in my paragraph 33 is the increased emphasis on ensuring competitiveness. The requirement for this competitiveness margin to be built into both the provision of housing and business land. And same as the previous NPS, it's as a minimum. And I think that's one of the, again, main differences between council's experts and our experts, which is it seems that council's expert is focusing on the minimum requirement and then saying, and that gives effect to the NPS, or that's not what the NPS limits you to, though. So what we're saying is beyond the minimum, because of the issues that this district has got a proven record of facing and not succeeding at, it's more appropriate to provide for more than just the minimum because of the challenges that this district is playing significant catch-up to address.
Are we now on a merits point rather than an issue about giving effect to the NPS? Is there really any difference between saying it's a minimum, or like the margin hasn't changed, and like it might be different if you were right on the margin, but I don't think that's the position. It's, and you're saying it is, as I understand your submission, and certainly the argument that Mr. Hocking makes in his summary, is that you need to aim higher in order to achieve the outcome you're seeking.
Yes.
But as I say, that's a merits point rather than a legal point of giving effect to the document.
Yep, that's right. And I guess that will tie into whatever Section 32AA further evaluation you end up doing when you're looking at what's most appropriate to give effect to the, you know, the relevant objectives here. Well, what we're saying is that this is the most appropriate way to address these affordability and so on objectives, not meeting the minimum required by the NPS, either NPS. Looking at my 33C, pick up on this responsiveness theme in the new NPS that Mr. Williams touches on as well, and I think that's particularly relevant to this case where, you know, maybe this submission and coming in stage three, which is the appropriate stage for it to come, if there's any sort of, I think there's some concern from the council's witnesses that this is somehow out of sync, but that responsiveness theme in the new national policy statement explicitly recognises that these sort of proposals that come from the market will be sometimes out of sync, and that's okay, and the council is still to sort of respond appropriately to them and be nimble. And then the final point I just want to emphasise, or one point there, F is, and you've been looking at policy six and you're really cognisant of the fact that the weighting has changed from the operative NPS, which was have regard to, I think, and I think it was PA4, to now have particular regard. So it's a notch up, and it's just a notch, but it is a notch up in terms of the weighting that decision makers are now to give to those things listed in policy six in particular. And there was one point I didn't write down in these submissions, but the how far out the new NPS looks and how it requires that every council look out to that long-term window, and that long-term window is defined as 30 years. And so that is a more long-reaching, far-sighted view of the duty of councils to provide for sufficient urban development capacity. So Mr. Williams goes into a lot of detail on the proposed district plan, so I didn't go through that anyway in much detail, unless you've got questions on that. Nope.
We'll keep that for Mr. Williams.
Okay. Scope to accept submission. Myself and Councillor for QLDC are on the same page that there is scope. So unless there's some concern from the panel, I wasn't going to go into my section on the submissions on that point.
I had two questions. I was, in terms of your paragraph 40, does it really meet the motor machinist's first test of examining the difference between the notified version and the status quo? Status quo being rural and the notified version being rural.
But it must, because it's the fact that in stage three, the zoning of Hawea itself was changed to low density residential, is, you know, which was a stage one zoning. So in Hawea is not the only place where that happened. It's happened in several pockets. And so when looking at extending the Hawea urban area in line with the stage one appeal point to extend the urban growth boundary, this is the appropriate stage in the process to do that. Building on that stage one appeal point that's transferred over to this process, the combination of that stage one urban growth boundary appeal point and Hawea bringing back into play the low-density residential zoning in stage three, directly adjacent to the Hawea boundary, seeking an extension of that. That is, in my submission, the appropriate way for the submitter to progress that relief.
The stage one submission relief that you're pursuing on appeal was just to not to have an urban growth boundary. It wasn't seeking rezoning of this land, was it?
No, it wasn't seeking rezoning. It was just about the urban growth boundary. Yep.
Like, I just want to get the basis of this clear, because to my mind, if this is within scope, it's within scope for the reason that Ms. Scott gave us,
yes,
that this is an incidental and consequential change, because this land has not changed its zoning in any version of the plan, therefore it necessarily can't meet Justice Kosher's first step and derive from Clearwater of it being the change from the status quo. But as I say, Ms. Scott accepted, because as she put it, I gave her the opportunity to tell me that it might not be, that it was incidental and consequential, and partly because of the way that the process is being staged, and you're bouncing from a rezoning over the road.
Mm.
It's a big bounce, but it's still, you're still reacting to what's happening over
That's
the road,
right.
rather than saying that what's proposed in the plan change is in fact incorrect. You just say it doesn't go far enough.
Mm. That's right. Yeah.
And,
yes.
And so therefore that's where the incidental bit comes in.
Yes, yes. Yep. So as a consequence of what was notified in stage three, the submission leverages off that. Yeah.
And my other question is, you said the section 32 evaluation report considered expansion of the UGB to the south. It's been a while since I read that. Can you point me to where in the section 32 analysis it does? Save me reading the whole thing again.
I can. I won't right now.
Not the second, but when you get a moment, can you find it and give me the reference?
Yep.
Thank you.
So I don't propose to go into the receiving environment in any more detail. I've talked a lot about the resource consent for the special housing area, and I've talked about agreeing that Shotover Park is the decision that gives you the discretion to take into account that receiving environment, that consented receiving environment.
In relation to the distinction you draw, this prompted me to reread Shotover Park.
Yep.
It seemed to me that Justice Fogarty had two reasons. And so if you read his paragraph 117 again, it seemed like he went down as an issue of principle. And then he said, and in the alternative, the consent subject to appeal, so you can't say it's going to likely to be relied on. So it seems that I understand the provisions. You've clearly reported the key provisions, but that was in the alternative. He had a quite discreet argument or a discreet line of reasoning.
And Obiter.
Well, that was his primary reason.
Mm.
That it is an issue of principle. Hawthorne didn't apply, and to plans because they were forward looking. That by definition, what is there currently may not be what you want.
Mm, mm, mm.
Can you really say it's over?
Well, I'll have a look at it. Yeah, yeah. But I guess in that likely to be implemented part of the limb, if you like, or further on, that's again where Mr. Hocking's evidence in particular will give you, in my submission, the confidence that it is likely to be implemented. And it will be appropriate for you to exercise your discretion and take that into account. So I will spend a little bit of time on Mr. Barr's proposed affordability criteria. It was a surprise to see it. You'll appreciate it was very prescriptive, without any sort of precedent or framework that sits behind it in the rest of the plan architecture. It's, as far as we're aware, it's only been proposed in respect of this submission, not in respect of council's own upzoning and infilling, and it's not being applied by other council officers in the context of other plan changes or submissions or variations. Now, on that last point, just as an example, a very recent example, and if it's of any further relevance to yourselves, I'll provide it, but at the planning committee meeting last week, there was a proposal for a variation at Sunshine Bay for the urbanisation of what's currently rural land, and that was council staff recommended that be accepted, and that's still going through the process. But what was interesting was how those council officers treated the contribution to affordability. And they were very explicit that going beyond a contribution of 5% would be unreasonable. That was one of the statements at paragraph 31 of the report, whereas Mr. Barr was proposing a 10 to 15% contribution, which is, in context of an RMA process, unprecedented in this district. and it was also it was live in the reporting officer's mind in the Sunshine Bay context, because they noted that rezonings generally do not offer any contribution to the Housing Trust, even though the cost of hearing submissions are being met by ratepayers as part of the district plan review process. So that, I guess, I just wanted to, as a concern in terms of this affordability recommendation of Mr. Barr's and in terms of infrastructure, that there's an inconsistency of approach from the council towards universal development submission compared to other upzonings, rezonings, infillings and so on. This affordability point is one of those inconsistencies of concern, particularly given how unprecedented the framework was that came out from Mr. Barr.
I understand all the points you're making. An alternative view might be that Universal has pitched its case firmly, and now reinforced by Mr. Hocking's summary, Mr. Copeland's further evidence, that it is pursuing this to aid affordability. The devil's advocate might suggest that Mr. Barr is saying, well, put your money where your mouth is. That is, you're advancing a position, and you say, well, all right, well, let's nail this, that this is actually what's going to happen. And that might be the distinguishing factor, that other developments may not be pushing their position quite so firmly on an affordability or contribution to affordability basis.
One aspect that I have a problem with Mr. Barr's proposal, though, I've got lots of problems with it, but one of them is that it appears that he's tried to use how you'd address a Special Housing Act proposal, which is a different statutory purpose to the RMA, and he's tried to bring that over and say it's entirely appropriate to do something even more more rigorous and prescriptive in an RMA context, with no policy support in the relevant architecture of the district plan, or even in the regional policy statement, and still not in the new national policy statement. So it sits.
With respect, Mr. Gallagher, I don't think you answered my question.
No,
you
I didn't.
Went to something entirely different. I understand that it's a valid point you're making, but as I say, it's not what I asked you.
No. So the answer to your question is the evidence of both Mr. Copeland and Mr. Hocking, which is that bringing more land to the market with multiple landowners will increase competitiveness and increase supply and address some of the issues that we're currently facing, the frictions, I think is Mr. Copeland's words, like land banking, Just the general lack of incentive for landowners to do that. So that, you know, that has been and still is the mechanism by which this rezoning does help the housing affordability issue. The volume, and it's the number of landowners, it's the competitiveness that it will enable and introduce. And Mr. Hocking and Mr. Copeland can talk about that much more eloquently than I can, I think.
Thank you.
Just on that point, if I may, Chair and Commissioner, with a totally open mind to the entire discussion, we've had more landowners brought to the market in the last 10 years. Has that assisted with housing affordability?
That's getting down to the level of detail that Mr. Hocking will be able to comment on, and Mr. Copeland. But if it is assisting, it hasn't reached the turning point yet, from what I understand the evidence is. And the process by which many of those landowners finally got to the market was a long and contentious one. So it's not an easy path for a lot of them.
Should we talk about infrastructure?
Yes. So, I was looking at Mr. Barr's evidence, and he says that his main reason for opposing the rezoning was infrastructure constraints. That's in his paragraph 3.1 of his rebuttal, which was curious because there seems to be no disagreement that there's physically a constraint to upgrading what's required. As far as I can tell, it's agreed that Hawea is already underserviced, so upgrade is inevitable. It's agreed that for council's proposed infilling of Hawea and for the now consented special housing area, upgrade is also needed. So there is going to be an upgrade that happens anyway. It's efficient to do that upgrade properly, for want of a better word. And physically, as I understand it, there's no disagreement that physically the capacity of the existing Hawea needs, the infilling of Hawea, the special housing area consent and the rezoning, physically that can all be catered for. So Mr. Barr's comment does not have any foundation that I can see, unless it's the same as the infrastructure experts from council, which is actually, it's not about the timing, and it's not about the physical ability to do it, it's just about the fact that we haven't budgeted for it yet. And that's not in their position, it's not their place to make that sort of statement. Everyone knows that for something like this, you wouldn't budget for it until you had some certainty it was had a place in the plan. And people also know that the options of development contributions or developer agreements with council do provide council with the certainty that it will get the funding at the appropriate time from the developer who is benefiting from the required infrastructure upgrade. So I just can't see any rational basis to find that infrastructure could be the reason that the principal planner would not support this submission.
Isn't one answer, to go back to the NPS, it talks about Objective 6, local authority decisions on urban development are integrated with infrastructure planning and funding decisions. That. It's one thing not to have it in the budget, but it's another thing not to have it in the LGP.
Mm. Yes, which is reviewed annually. So if this rezoning is approved and has legal effect from the time you make your decision, that will most likely be insufficient time for the next March annual plan to start factoring that into its budget, bearing in mind that there will already be a line item for hardware upgrades anyway, because it's inevitably happening. It's just that the scale of that upgrade can be done in a comprehensive and integrated way. It's not, you know, it's not too late at all. No one's saying it's too late to do it, because they haven't finalised their design or anything like that. They are in the process of doing it, so it's the perfect timing to do it efficiently and integrate it. So it's not inconsistent with that objective. The other point is, as I said when I opened, what Mr. Williams is proposing is that instead of subdivision in accordance with the structure plan being controlled, to make sure council's got the confidence that it can integrate the planning and funding process as this zone gets given effect to or used, that if it's a restricted discretionary subdivision application, infrastructure, you know, servicing is properly dealt with at that point also.
You know, I have in mind cases like Forward that talk about the need to have those things line up before you rezone, and that zoning without certainty of infrastructure, or at least a council commitment to it, is inconsistent with sustainable management.
But I don't think that threshold is reached here, because like I say, the servicing, the upgrade required, there's no disagreement that it physically can be catered for. So it's not like we're just going to get to that point at subdivision and go, oh, okay, how are we going to address wastewater discharge and supply of water? We know, you know, it's not contentious that the capacity is able to be met. It's able to be met through an upgrade that's going to happen anyway. It's an efficient time to do it. So I don't think it fits in that category of zoning something without... What I'm trying to say is you can make a finding with confidence that servicing can be provided for. You do have the evidence in front of you that gives you that ability. So you can conclude that this would, you know, meet the purpose of the Act if you approve this rezoning.
But isn't that always the case? It's always an issue of funding. Like, I don't know how many engineers have told me that they can do anything as long as there's a big enough budget. So infrastructure provision, like there are cases that do turn on physical inability, but most of them are about council decisions, and there are resounding statements that I can recall reading about plan provisions not coercing councils to making funding decisions.
Mm.
As well, that, like, I go back to the RPS, isn't there a need to integrate all these, to have all these ducks in a row?
But I agree, and that's my submission, that the ducks are in a row. And again, Mr. Hocking and Mr. Williams and Mr. Waite, I think, had a meeting with council mid-July, and maybe, as a result of that, I think there was more alignment between the submitter and the infrastructure team at council about, well, yes, this is the right time to do it. Physically, there's no problem. It can be done. Next conversation is, okay, well, let's agree on the funding mechanism. Tick. All the ducks are there. And no adverse effect on the ratepayers, so on and so forth.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions anyone has on infrastructure issues?
And that you're saying that irrespective of the specific solution, so for example, in a lot of the evidence there's a reliance on connection with Project Pure.
Mm-hmm.
So if that wasn't the solution, irrespective of whatever the solution is, this is the time to do it, is what you're saying.
Well, my understanding, but again, Mr. Hocking and Mr. Waite can clarify that, is that there's general agreement that Project Pure is the solution, and that this can integrate with that.
And that may be the case between Mr. Hocking and Council, Universal and Council, but you have Devon Dairies, you have a bridge across the Hawea, the Clutha. There's a lot of other obstacles in the way that are not necessarily land on agreement. So irrespective of the solution, you're saying that the infrastructure tick can be ticked.
To the same extent that Council's own Stage 3 infilling of Hawea can tick the infrastructure box, because it's obviously determined that that's okay, in spite of what you're saying are some final issues to address. If that what's good for the goose is good for the gander, so yes.
I was just reading Mr. Powell's rebuttal. And he says, I acknowledge there are feasible solutions for servicing the site.
Yes.
But they're not funded. They're not planned and they're not funded.
So if you're an argument that they're not planned or funded at the moment, but they will be, we can have confidence that they will be.
Yes.
He says that the wastewater, for example, he says the planned connection is to remove the capacity issues for the current growth forecast for Hawea, not to deal with any additional rezoning.
Which is logical, because that's what they've currently, in a certain sense, got on the table in front of them. But they haven't finalised that, they're not building it right now. That, you know, it's the perfect opportunity to make sure that's actually really future proofed.
The scale that would come out.
The scale, yeah. Mm.
One, just a bit of point of clarification about the, you mentioned the 15-metre bra extending up the main road.
Mm-hmm.
Is that along the unformed legal road that's the bike path, or along the main, to that point, you should say, and then at the universal boundary, or is that all the way to Cemetery Road, so therefore including what is the street?
All the way, so if you look at when you get to Mr. Williams' evidence, and might actually pay to have that hand, yeah, you'll see it goes all the way along Domain Road, all the way up to Cemetery Road now.
Right.
The 15 metre bra.
Yep, so that's over the other portion of which I thought was the.
Yeah, that unformed legal road.
So, does that go up here or this?
The second one.
Thank you.
Western boundary. Yes.
And one other is, there was mentioned, there was a discussion about, and I'm not sure if this is a question for you, but I'm happy to give it to you, is you mentioned discussion about the horse being bolted when housing development crossed the rise and went down. There was some evidence or discussion about the area of land as is detailed on the Gladstone Gap flood from being a defensible edge,
mm-hmm.
but that development that came up over the ridge has actually already been granted and intruded into that. So is that a defensible edge, or has that, because there is already development zoned in that area, has that horse already bolted as well?
Well, I think in terms of the physical constraint for that, probably Mr. Forrest is the best person to talk to about that. And
so potentially I could just highlight that for Mr. Forrest.
Yes.
And then one last question, if I may, with the Chair's leave, is with regard to the NPS, Objective 8, which urban environments and talks about New Zealand's urban environments support reductions in greenhouse gases and are resilient in terms of current and future effects of climate change. And there's a bit of mention through the objectives on that just wondering what your thoughts were with regard to that for development, or that in general moving forward, how much weight to apply to that particular objective.
So there's probably two main thoughts come to mind. One is the way that, and Mr. Williams talks about the live, work, play concept. So by having both the local centre, local shopping centre zone and the industrial zone, there's the opportunity for some, you know, some of the new residents to not have to drive a long way to their place of work. So that's one aspect of it. And the other is that it's a flat, sunny site. So it's, you know, in that really basic sense, it's well placed for well designed, modern, warm, efficient houses, solar gain benefits and so on, and therefore less energy use and more wellbeing for the people who get to live there. So off the top of my head, those are two climate change relevant points that would be relevant to that objective, and I think it's a policy as well.
And that potentially wouldn't extend to, or would it extend to built form, concrete versus timber, or?
Well, this submission doesn't look at built form, and it's been tricky to, I've looked at this for the New Zealand Green Building Council as well, whether or not a plan can lever a higher building standard than the building code. And there's a section in the Building Act that says you can't.
Yeah.
So it's really difficult. It's really difficult for a plan to do that legally until they look at the Building Act itself and sort that out.
I realise I'm cutting straws, but I've been trying to attack the Building Act for years.
Yep.
No, it's aside. Thank you very much.
We can start with Mr. Hawking.
Yes, thanks. So I've got some copies of Mr. Hawking's evidence, a summary to hand up. I've got some more of that one if you did.
You, Mr. Hawking.
Okay. Would you like me to read verbatim my summary?
Yeah, just read the summary. Okay. Thanks for our benefit.
My name is Lane Hawking, and I'm the owner and director of Universal Developments and trustee of LAC Property Trustees Limited. In this summary, I'll focus on supply and affordability. It's appropriate to start my summary by addressing any concerns of PDP zoning usurping the SHA resource consent and ultimately leading to the abandonment of the SHA. There's zero chance Universal won't execute the SHA. The site is now ready for civil construction. Detailed engineering design is almost complete, and we're currently working on the engineering approval documentation. Trademark branding has been created, and the intention is for a full launch later this year. As an example of our conviction, we offered the QLDC a deed guaranteeing development. They did not need that. As noted in my evidence, I have a major frustration with the council relying on the Economist report, which states there's enough zoning until 2046. There's a very simple question that can be asked. If there's enough zoning, why are prices so high? The answer is that existing zoning does not equal supply. Whether the reason for existing zoned land not being turned into titled sections is incidental, as in the case of Mumdale development inertia, or deliberate, as in the case of land banking, it still has the same effect. Zoning does not equate to supply. Property market pricing supports this. The demand I'm seeing supports this. The Mayor's Office and the QLCHT, Queensland Lakes Community Housing Trust, support this. Craig Barr has now acknowledged this. The service workers who leave the district are evidence of this, and importantly, the Economist's report explicitly references this. Developments such as North Lake and Shotover Country had protracted battles with council on zoning. Imagine the extreme district-wide issues we would be facing had these two developers simply agreed with the council and not continually pushed for zoning. Where would people be living now? The solution is to create zoning and ultimately supply and competition. Infrastructure. I have three main points to make on this topic. This is the time to ensure a long-term view of how our infrastructure is taken and capacity to meet future needs is identified. Until now, Council's position has not been supported by modelling. We've had two meetings very recently with the Council, and I'm encouraged by Council staff confirming modelling is now being undertaken and that it will look at the additional capacity associated with the rezoning. Universal is happy to work with the Council on funding options. I have confirmed with Council our willingness to forward fund infrastructure if needed, so as to ensure the timely supply of infrastructure for the rezoning and wider township. Affordability measures. I was going to relabel this ramblings of a madman. I'm unable to reconcile the Council trying to supply of land with them, trying to limit supply of land with them then wanting to apply affordability measures. It's most unusual. Increasing supply is the most effective way to address pricing. A further concern is the difficulty and inequity of any affordability mechanism. Development costs of creating titled sections don't change when an affordability overlay is applied. So who decides the lucky buyers that get subsidised versus the unlucky ones who do the subsidising? Seeking affordability measures is misguided at best and monopolistic opportunism at worst. If one wants to address affordability, it's best done via supply. Industrial zoning. I again struggle with the Economist evidence and modelling that suggests sufficient industrial land exists and that it should be confined to Wanaka. As part of the community consultation on the special housing area, one of the matters that came up repeatedly was whether land would be made available for tradesmen's yards, etc., within the township. Our proposed industrial zoning is logical. Being located off the main road, it ensures heavy vehicles are away from residential areas and yet provides good access to the wider area. In my opinion, limiting industrial zoning to Wanaka is anti-competitive and will do nothing to serve the Hawea community. COVID-19. COVID-19 is a temporary reprieve and potentially less impactful than predicted. It should not derail the focus on long-term affordability in our district. If land such as the subject site isn't zoned, it ultimately ends up as ad hoc lifestyle blocks. This creates major continuity issues when the Council finally deems the timing right for comprehensive development. The ongoing issues at Lady's Mile are the perfect illustration of this. Zoning this land is an essential element in making a material impact on affordability in our district. Our intention can be seen by us proposing zoning on land owned by 13 different owners. We're not seeking control, we're seeking supply and competition. Take advantage of a cooperative developer who is known to be quick, works well with the council, and is able to pre-fund infrastructure. In evidence, we've heard a lot about DPR, PDP, MPS, UDC, HDCA, BDCA, HBA, etc. But when we cut through the jargon and distill the arguments to the core issue of whether there is enough supply, how can anybody rationally say there is? And were they to argue there is, how can they account for the extreme price levels this district continually sees? I leave you with two very simple questions. Why are prices so high? What is the harm in providing more sections in a growing district?
Mr. Hocking, a question of clarification. You said at paragraph 5, you offered a QLDC a deed guaranteeing development. They didn't need it.
Yes.
That's ambiguous. Did they say they didn't want it?
They said they didn't want it.
Thank you. Second is that I've heard some of the arguments rehearsed, and one of the things I've been told about previous council attempts to provide for greater density of development through medium density zoned land is that that land in Wanaka is being used for large, expensive, standalone homes because that's easier for the developers to get away and it's more certain profit. But I understand, put the SHA aside, there are all sorts of conditions on you that that Ms. Baker Galloway. What's the assurance for the panel But as regards the balance of the rezoning you're seeking, that the end result won't be a large supply of unaffordable homes.
So I would have to say, anybody involved in property development, whether as a commissioner or whether as a planner or whether as a developer themselves, there's a very common tenet with development, which is profitability is through density. That's irrefutable. And I think in Hawea, the demand is not for bigger sections, the demand is for smaller sections, the demand is for affordable sections. And if we go on to TradeMe and take a look at what is available, you will not find a section with a 2 in it anywhere in this district. You'll find a lot of sections that have a 4, 5, 6, 7 and even 1 and 2 million in them, anywhere from 800 square metres up to 2,000 square metres. So there is supply of that, there is no shortage of that, yet there is a total shortage of affordable sections that are sensible sizes and at a price that have a high 1 to a mid to high 2 in them. So you could argue cynically that as a developer, I'm simply going to chase the demand. You could also overlay that with, I've put my name on the line and I've gone out on a limb and have said this is what we're going to do, and ultimately, historically, what I've said we're going to do is exactly what we do execute. And we have the added benefit here of, this is my company, I'm the sole director, sole owner, sole funder. So it's not a rezoning execution by committee, it's my focus and my word. We have an interest list of over 300 people looking for affordable sections, and we've not done any advertising.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you. The question I've got for you, and I'll ask the question and I'll just clarify. The question is whether you think there is a place in the Resource Management Act in planning for affordable housing provisions. And I'll ask Mr. Williams the same thing, but I'm looking from your developer perspective, because you seem to be suggesting that, you know, seeking affordability measures is misguided. Of course, you've got the SHA where you've got them, and there's zero chance that you won't give effect to that. So is effectively the affordable housing provisions, I mean, that was the deal that came with the special housing areas, but outside of that, is it your view that it is about supply and it's about choice and opportunity as opposed to putting in affordability provisions?
Yes, so let me deal with the SHA first. The affordability provisions within the SHA legislation and then done locally with the council, that's a very, very strong case of quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. And there are some very forgiving parts of the SHA or the HESHA legislation. Mm-hmm. And a couple of examples of that are it doesn't require, I guess it's a fast track. And the other thing is, when you look at the HESHA legislation, it's not subject to appeal, mm-hmm. and it doesn't require formal public notification. Even though the council did choose to notify it, and we did have a long community engagement process, that's not a requirement of HESHA legislation. That was our choice to do it at guidance from councillors and the council. The second thing is, yes, definitely. For me, I can't reconcile how the council can sit there and go, we want to limit supply, there is enough to 20,046, excuse me. Yet on the other hand, and immediately say we need to enact some provisions around affordability. I can't reconcile those two positions. So my view, to answer the final part of your question, is yes, supply, supply, supply. And that's not via one developer, it's via many. And if you have a look at the overlay, what we've got here, what we're proposing to rezone, there's 13 owners, and there's going to be more than that as people buy from the Chris Street subdivision. We're not looking for control. We're simply looking for supply, 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 and competition. And that way, the affordability should be met. I think the council's premature in talking about this until they've actually gone through a process, let's call it one market cycle, of being fully supportive of supply coming to market and zoning.
Is it then, I mean, do you see, well, and the question is who pays for the affordable housing? So what is it that you just take a hit, or is it simply a wealth transfer that you need to recoup that somewhere else?
Yes, that's what it is. Like when we, as I've said in my evidence, when you have an affordability overlay, that doesn't change the cost of a legal team, the cost of the platform, whatever it might be. It doesn't change the cost of implementing of the civils construction. So that has to come from somewhere. So if they're saying, okay, we need you to subsidise this, it has to come from somewhere. Otherwise people won't develop the land. And so then you come to this philosophical question is, who do you choose? Who are the lucky people? Who are the unlucky people? So it's fraught with issues from what I see, and still premature. Get some supply and competition in the market, and if that doesn't work, maybe then take that next step. But there's always going to be someone subsidising someone else when you implement affordability measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dawson.
Just coming back to the business side of it, with the industrial zoning. As the Chairman said, we're hearing industrial zoning next week, so we've already got a lot of evidence coming to us about the industrial zoning in Wanaka, where people are saying there's plenty of supply, we don't need, you know, council doesn't need to have so much dedicated general industrial zone. They can downgrade, well, not downgrade, but upgrade it, whichever way around you want to look at it,
yes.
and allow lots of other activities to come into those areas that the council might have wanted to have as industrial. So I'm interested in your perspective on, I suppose, the general availability or need for zoning in the Wanaka area generally,
yes.
And then your perspective on, is it really a Wanaka area generally question, or is it a Hawea versus
yes.
Wanaka question?
Yes. And would you like me to include commercial and industrial?
No, just the industrial.
Just
yeah.
the industrial.
Yeah, because the commercial, I think the commercial.
Yes, it would be different. Interesting to know who's putting that forward, that there is enough zoning here for industrial. From what I see, let's deal with Wanaka first,
well,
and then
yeah.
we'll talk
so
about
so it's
how
not the council that's saying there's enough. They're saying
yes, that's
they're,
right.
Yeah, it's
and
actually the people that own the land.
Yes, well, that sort of half answers my question, even though I guess I'm not allowed to ask questions.
But you're saying more. You're saying you need even more again.
I think you need more, and the reason I'd say you need more is because it's very closely held and it's drip-fed into the market and there's price controlling around that. Anytime you don't have competition, whichever market you're talking about, property or cars, whatever it may be, pricing is not going to be as competitive as it otherwise would be. And my feeling is people who are saying there's enough industrial zoning here, potentially they have a vested interest in the industrial zoning staying where it is or being made slightly smaller. So that's my view on Wanaka. With Hawea, what I can say is we saw a lot of engagement from the public during the SHA where people are saying, what are we going to have for industrial zoning out here? And the typical example is a tradesman. He's got his own building company and he builds houses in Wanaka and or Hawea, yet there is literally nowhere for him to put his business in Hawea. And that's inconvenient, it's expensive. You could even argue that goes against the council's 2019 adoption of the environmental concerns, because he's running in and out of Wanaka all the time, where from a sustainability perspective, it would be much better if he had somewhere in Hawea, and there is simply nowhere.
Because there's actually no industrial zoning or even anything
literally
like
zero.
It, other than the service station, or even if it might even be zoned.
That's right. And this is a town with over 3,000 people now, and the benefit of the subdivisions historically in Hawea have been that they've been more affordable. Now that Wanaka's become so ill-affordable, people are moving geographically outwards, and so even Hawea now is very expensive. Notwithstanding that, the people that have moved to Hawea in the last 3 years are generally younger and related to the trades and things like that. and they are doing a lot of kilometres back and forward.
Well, I live at Albertown. I have a house there, so you see them every day.
Yes.
But you know, you're asking for 9 hectares, which is quite a lot. I mean, how do you decide on that amount?
Yes. Well, if we have a look at the plan, and it shows the zoning there at the southern end,
mm-hmm.
we've gone the full width. And part of the reason, look, it's very simple, to be honest with you. You make less money out of industrial than you do out of residential.
We hear that next week as well.
Everybody knows that. But I'm looking at this as a major long-term plan. It's got continuity, it's got sustainability, and when we look at the industrial zoning there, yes, it is large at 9 hectares exactly, but it achieves two things: future-proofing, and also it was located here because I think it makes a very, very nice defensible boundary. Now, it would be difficult to have a defensible boundary if we only had it halfway across, for example, or made it half the size by only having it half the depth. So, pragmatically, you go the width, you go, this is a very nice bookend, this is a defensible boundary, you're going to have a road, and then people coming off each side, that's just the size that comes out of the spreadsheet. And I don't see that as a bad thing, I see that as long-term planning for a district which is growing and a township which is growing and has literally no industrial land at the moment. My mantra is supply, 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 and let's look out 20, 30 years. Not 2 to 5 years.
I suppose I'm thinking, you know, if you looked out 50, 100 years, this area to the south of Hawea is the only way to go for Hawea. I mean, and eventually you get to Hawea Flat.
Yes.
But this zones right through the middle of that area. How do you long-term, I mean, we've got, in Wanaka we've got Anderson Road, sort of the industrial zone that used to be on the edge of the town and now is being, really should probably be residential. So how do you plan to future-proof that sort of long-term thinking rather than just saying, well, okay, here's my boundary, I'm having this on my end of my boundary.
Yeah.
You know, how do we know this is the best place for industrial rather than just a convenient boundary for you?
We've responded to concerns with the council, and some of the primary concerns are around defensible boundary. And I thought this was a reasonably pragmatic answer to those concerns. If we look forward at 80 to 100 years and you're saying, have you now got an industrial area right in the middle of a residential zone? You could take this up, rotate it by 90 degrees, and put it all the way down the side of Domain Road, for example.
Mm.
And that's actually how I had it originally.
Yeah.
I like that for a whole host of reasons. It's imminently accessible from Domain Road. Mm. It can be carved away out of let's call it harm's way of the residential district. But we changed it here when we kept hearing, this is too much, this is too far, why would we do anything beyond maybe the water race? And I thought, hey, what a nice pragmatic answer. There's your defensible boundary. You raise a point which we think about, and that's in our paradigm, but the council doesn't think that far ahead, and their focus has been a defensible boundary. You move this 90 degrees and put it down Domain Road, I think it's a better location, and I think your problem's solved.
To me, it's more like having a Ballantyne Road versus an Anderson Road, if you know what I mean.
I'm in complete agreement with that.
Mm. Oh, well. I think that's all my questions on industrial. Thank you.
Just a thing to start with. I think that in 100 years' time, I can guarantee I won't be sitting here discussing this particular outcome. But the one question, I'm interested in your vision
yes.
for this, because we've had a couple of discussions about people and industry. So, you know, have you got, because with, and this is with respect, and we had a conversation about the city of Bergen and, you know, heating supply for the whole development, potentially making this, if it got to the stage where it was approved, what's the vision?
The vision? I'm happy you asked that. The vision for me, if we have a look at the map, the core of my vision is a happy community, and that happiness is based off convenience, sustainability and amenity. Three words used a lot these days. But if you ever look running through the middle, we've got that water race. That water race.
Can you slow down? I missed that. Three words.
Oh, yeah.
Capture for posterity.
I think I forgot. Yeah,
convenience, sustainability, and.
Are they a part of your DNA?
Amenity.
Amenity.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you in
mid flow. It's being recorded anyway. That you
yeah. I've lost my point.
Water
I'm joking. So if we have a look in the middle here. That's a water race, and that's very roughly 3.5 kilometres long. That water race has crystal clear water for the dam in it from October to April each year, and it's simply for the use of irrigators who are part of the Hawea Irrigation Company. I think this can form, if we jump forward 20 years, I think this can form the absolute heart of one of the best communities in New Zealand, and I genuinely believe this. And so what we have planned, I've mentioned it to a few people, and I've had a meeting with the Hawea Irrigation Company on site, and they're supportive of that. What I want to do with that is not put it underground. So if we have a look at the dark shaded area to the west of the site, you can see the red dotted line is where it comes into my land from the west of Domain Road. That developer is piping it and putting it underground. That leads to a superior profitability profile for the project, but I think it takes away from the amenity and happiness of people in the community. So my vision for that is to be the heart. And I would love, as I say, we come here in 10 or 20 years. There are houses around here. There is some higher density because I like higher density living. I've lived overseas for a long time, and I think it leads to very good outcomes for community. We shouldn't be afraid of density. Someone gets up in the morning, they go, I'm going to go for a run along this track and back, and then I'm going to go down to the local licensed cafe and I'm going to have my Eggs Benedict and my fancy coffee or whatever it may be. So our plan, and I've outlined this to the Hawea community, the Hawea Irrigation Company, and they're supportive of it, is to have a running track on both sides of this, and it meets up with that track that goes down on our western boundary, which goes all the way down to the domain, and has it's effectively, we'll call it the Hawea cycle track, and it will be to a high enough quality where you can push a pram or kids can ride their small wheeled scooters, and it will be planted, and as I say, half the year it's flowing with crystal clear water. So for me, what is my vision? We jump for 10 or 20 years, someone gets up in the morning, goes for a run, drops the kids off at school, talks with their friends, pushing a pram or whatever it might be. I also have a vision along here of a sculpture park, and also I would like fitness equipment like you would see somewhere at Venice Beach in California, for example, with our rings and chin-up bars and step up post, those sorts of things. And if we can do that, then I think this will be a very, very successful subdivision, or let's call it growth of community, and that's my commitment and that's my excitement with this project, and they're not just words, that's genuine.
Thank you for that. That leads on to, you mentioned sections with a two in front of them.
Yes.
Absolutely no disrespect, sir, but I've heard that a few times from a few developers, that supply, affordability, directly across from this proposal, there's a subdivision that was the criteria was affordability, and they ended up in the fours and the fives.
They did.
What's your commitment?
100%. supply, supply, supply. If you supply these sections, the prices can't be pushed up. The supply can't be controlled. And remember, we're talking here about ultimately 13 different owners. I'm not the only owner here. And I think, as I said in my evidence, I think that goes to show my conviction, and I don't want to use the word purity of our intention, but it does show that we're not trying to control anything here. And I think, Callum, in your experience, if you know the subdivision, the land I've bought, and the speed with which it comes on the market and is executed, we're known as a fast developer. I have no funding from a bank. It's me that makes the decisions, and the decisions and the focus for my platform going forward is supply, supply, supply. We're even going to have some sections in the SHA with a one in them.
This is showing my ignorance about the district. What are the other subdivisions you've been involved in the Wanaka
yes,
area?
Yes, okay, so the first one is called Dungarvan, which is a redevelopment of
the
old Wanaka Primary School. The next one was The Heights, which is on Albury Road, which is 161 lots.
Which used to be council land.
It was council land. Yeah. We bought that from
King's
the council in 2016 June. And then the next one is in front of Sticky Forest, and that's called Clearview, which is 116 lots. And we bought that land, well, we contracted for it in February last year. It settled in October, and we've sold 80% of them already, and we've completed earthworks, and we're 30% of the way through stage one, which is 59 lots, civil construction at the moment. So civil construction will be finished at the end of this year. So that speaks to how fast we are as a developer.
And they're all relatively recent.
Yes.
And one final, if I may, the BRA that you extended, which is now 15 metres all around, it just leaves, apart from the SHA, it just leaves one gap at the end of the industrial. And if you do have this, you know, pushing a pram cycle around the whole thing, and agreed you probably don't want to be pushing a pram past the industrial, but there does seem to be a small, almost dead-end gap if you have it. So that's the south-eastern component of the industrial.
I don't see that, do you? No, I don't see any break. It might be a printing error.
There's just this little piece here.
Right, can I approach?
I'm not sure about the conventions.
Absolutely. You can whack him over the head while you're at it.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chair.
This is it here.
Oh, gotcha. So it is a printing error, or maybe it's just a translation error. Thank you.
It's the whole way around, and that's because...
Oh, you might.
It's
just as a text. You must have a new version.
Then you don't have to back it.
Gotcha.
Thank you. There you go. So given that Commissioner Dawson had a similar gap, I think you can whack her in the head as well.
Oh, no. I wouldn't say that.
Oh, sorry. No, absolutely. In which case, I do come back to, land banking has been highlighted through lots of evidence and pieces of evidence in here as an issue, and we all recognise that for this district. And the what we have to rely on is using a developer that brings property to market, and that's, in my estimation, is potentially what we've still got to rely on. I do have an open mind on this, and I will look forward to seeing the results of that. Thank you very much, Mr. Hawking.
On that note, those of us who have been going hard at it might stop for a cuppa.
Very good.
Stop for 10 minutes. Restart at 3 o'clock.
Thanks.